This Talking Flutes podcast is kindly sponsored by Trevor James Flutes, making life sound beautiful. You can show them some flute love by following them on Instagram at TJ Flutes, Trevor James Flutes on Facebook, and at trevorjamesflutes.com.
Hello, this is Talking Flutes, and my guest today really needs no introduction other than to say he's one of the world's most exciting flutists, and he has arguably the best job in the world as principal flute of the London Symphony Orchestra. And I'm thrilled to chat to him today. It is, of course, Gareth Davis. Hello, Gareth.
Hi, Claire.
How are you doing?
I'm all right, actually. I'm sitting at home, as are lots of people at the moment, doing lots of things on Zoom. And fortunately, we're lucky enough to be doing some concerts for live streaming. So we've been sort of back at work a little bit, which has been great, actually. But it's also nice to be at home, I have to admit.
Yeah, I agree. There are some nice things about the restrictions and some terrible things. And as you said, we're recording over Zoom, so apologies if the sound quality is not quite up to our normal level. At least it gives us a chance to hear you and hear about your incredible career. I had talked to you about a few questions to sort of get us started. I mean, there are so many things I'd like to talk to you about today. Your areas of great interest, of course, is playing and teaching and writing. But let's start with many young flutists, when asked about their aspirations, would say, I want to be principal flute of the LSO. So was that yours?
No. I mean, my brother is a professional guitarist. And actually, my sons are also musicians now as well. I tried to put them off, but there you go. When I was a kid, my father's Welsh, so there was always a lot of singing going on. It was mainly male voice choirs, but he had a record collection with lots of Mozart symphonies and Beethoven and stuff like that, which I remember always being on in the mornings, on a Sunday morning, or when my mum was cooking lunch, we'd have these classical music on. And I just really sort of associate it with a really sort of happy childhood, really. But we didn't talk about classical music. I do remember watching The Ring Cycle when I was about 10. It was on BBC Two on a Sunday evening. And it was a bit like watching probably Netflix now, you know, where you watch a new episode each week. And I remember watching it and being sort of slightly transfixed by the whole thing. I had no idea what was going on. But music wasn't really, it wasn't a career option. It wasn't something I'd been trained to do since I was four. I actually, when I was at my first school, we had a Welsh headmaster called Mr. Whitney, who was very big on singing. That's everybody had to sing. And I loved singing, but it wasn't a conscious thing. That's just what I like doing, you know. And when you're young, you don't think about it. And the music teacher at the school, I don't know, parents' evening or something, I don't know when, said, "Oh, Gareth's got a really good ear," because we'd often sing in the car on the way to Granny's house, and we'd all just, you know, I'd always try and sing a third below or something like that because I thought it sounded nice, you know. But nothing, you know, I was hardly precocious. It's just, that's just what we did. And anyway, she said, "He's got a good ear. Does he play an instrument?" Again, it wasn't really on the radar. I think both my mum and dad had dabbled at the piano when they were kids, but had given up and you know, had proper jobs. And they said, no, never really done that. So they asked me if I wanted to play an instrument. I wanted to play the trumpet. My mum said it was too loud, apparently. And my son plays a trumpet, and she was right. And so I had to choose something else. And at the time, there was a very famous Irish flautist who you may have heard of called James Galway. And I saw him on Blue Peter. And, you know, and at the time, it was very much like in my 10-year-old's brain, I think I was about 10 when I started, that the trumpet was a boy's instrument and the flute was a girl's instrument. And that's just the way it was. And that was the sort of prevailing attitude amongst my peers of 10-year-olds. And, you know, there's nothing worse than being a bit girly or something like that back in the 70s. So when I saw Jimmy on Blue Peter, who had this huge beard and had like jewelry and was quite cool, and he was playing this stuff, and it was like, wow, that's really cool. And he said it was easy to play. So I thought, I'll have a go at that. And then I just kind of took to it, really. I mean, you know, the advantage of the flute is it's not very difficult to play. You know, in your first lesson, you can make a sound that's recognisably a flute, which is not the same for the violin. You know, that's quite painful for parents for many, many years. And the flute, fortunately, you know, you can do, I mean, back then it was grade three was the lowest grade you could do. Yep. But you can do your grade three fairly quickly on in your flute playing career, as it were. So I like the fact it was quick. It was very similar to singing, you know, and that's still one of the things that attracts me now about playing in the orchestra. And it just went from there. But certainly, I did not ever at any point think, oh, I'm going to do this for a job. I mean, I do feel like a bit of an imposter. I'm sure that somebody's going to find me out. And I mean, you said in your very kind introduction that I need no introduction. I certainly don't feel that that's the case.
I think you're a very recognisable figure from all the things that you've done in your career so far, and certainly from your sparkling performances in the orchestra. So let's move on from 10 years old then. So you started to play the flute and it got a bit more serious, and then what happened?
Yeah, well, actually, I really wanted to play rugby for Wales. And I broke my arm in a collar and cuff right up round my neck for months. It was a really bad break. I was quite sporty. I used to love going out on my BMX bike. I played rugby for the local team. I was a swimming club captain, and all that stopped. And of all my hobbies, the only thing I was able to do for months was play the flute. Fortunately, my arm was recovering, my left arm, and it was held up exactly where the flute was. So it was kind of like that's the only thing I could do. And I do remember around that time playing more.
So Gareth, we just had a little bit of problem with our connection. So we might have lost a bit of the detail about your arm being in a sling at the right angle to play the flute.
Yeah, so I mean, that was the end of my rugby career. I never did play for Wales. Although there is a famous rugby player called Gareth Davis now. So
there is.
So there we are. I basically just ended up playing a bit more because it was the only one of my hobbies that I had left that I could actually do for a while. And I just sort of carried on like that. There was a moment where I didn't really do competitions. I wasn't in the flute circuit and stuff. I've always felt a bit of an outsider in that respect. And I applied to go on the BBC Young Musician of the Year competition. It was the 1991. So it took place in 1989. And I managed to, I didn't get through, I did an audition, and it was very scrappy. I was one of those kids that, you know, I remember playing the Chaminade in one of the auditions, sort of, it went up and down in about the right place, but I didn't really have it under my fingers. I just like playing pieces. I didn't really practice, as it were, which is exactly the opposite of how I work now. But I managed to get in. I don't know how it worked, but I got a phone call saying, actually, you got in. And I was just overjoyed because, I mean, I played, I got through to the wind final, which I was amazed at. But what it did was, I remember in the adjudications afterwards, they had little parties afterwards. Dave, and he said, I mean, what have you been doing? You sound completely different. And it was simply confidence. I mean, I hadn't done anything. Mm-hmm. And having that confidence. So, you know, when I teach now, I always try and instill confidence in my pupils. I don't want to break people down. You need to build them up because it's difficult enough. But I then decided to audition for music college. And again, didn't know anything about it. And I did this, the auditions. I auditioned to basically all the major music colleges in Britain. And I got rejected in every single one of them, apart from the Guildhall, where I got a reserve place. I can remember auditioning at the Royal Academy, and I walked in, and it was really scary at the time. That was the place where everybody wanted to go. Mm. And it was like walking into a bear pit. It was hideous. I absolutely hated it. And I thought,
what year was this?
This would have been 1989. The auditions in 1989.
So
maybe 1989.
Yeah, because I mean, there were always scary things, but I think at that particular time, the Academy did have the reputation of being a little bit sort of intimidating and scary.
It was really intimidating. I mean, I have to say that the players on the panel weren't intimidating, but the general atmosphere there, it was. I really thought I wasn't good enough either. I remember I walked in the room, and on the panel was Kate Hill, Baz Bell, and Wib. And I walked in, and I'm sure my knees were visibly shaking, and I walked in, and Wib was, you know, they were all writing and reading their papers, and Wib looked at my application form, and then he looked up. I'd never met him at this point, and he looked up and he said, "Ah, Gareth Davis, are you related to Gareth Morris?" And everybody in the room just sort of looked and went, and I said, "No, I'm not." Anyway, oh, okay. And then, of course, you had to play the 4A fantasy. And I was so terrified. I remember the piano started, dung, ching, dung, ching. And then for my first note, I played at least five different ones as I blew in the wrong place and it shook. And they all started writing. And I thought, you know, I might as well just stop now. And I didn't get a call back. And I went to do the piano theory bits and everything. And I said to the guy, "Look, I haven't been called back. Am I going to get a place?" He went, "Probably not." And he said, "Do you want to go?" I said, "I think I'm just going to go home." So I did. And I just thought, maybe this isn't for me, you know. Anyway, I got a reserve place at the Guildhall. For those of you that don't know, that means basically if somebody else, you know, they offer, I don't know, let's say four places a year. And of course, if there's six really good players that go and audition at all those places, they often tend to get offered places at all the places, but they can only accept one. And I was fortunate in that whoever had been offered that place didn't want it. And just before Christmas, I got offered a place at the Guildhall as a reserve. So I felt like I got in by the back door. And then I met Edward Beckett, and he scared the living daylights out of me. And I realised how far I had to. I was so far behind, so far behind. And he was a very hard taskmaster and gave me a massive kick up the backside, which I hated, but I really, really needed.
So I hate to ask this, Gareth, but might I have been on the panel at the Royal Northern? Did you audition there?
I didn't audition at the Royal Northern.
Thank goodness.
No, I can say that honestly. So no, I'm not just saying that because this is your podcast. I really didn't.
I can safely say then that I did not reject you, Gareth, as an
No. Well, you would have been quite within your rights to do so. I mean, the thing is, you know, some of the kids I hear auditioning now, their technical ability is amazing. You know, back then I just wasn't doing it. I mean, it's funny because I think it's benefited me in the long run. I was really lucky when I was 16, I got a county scholarship, which no longer exists, to the junior department at the Guildhall. And I had probably my most influential flute teacher in Evelyn Frank. And she taught, I mean, she was lovely. When we were still in touch now, and she talked to me about colour and about quality of tone and beauty of line and phrasing in a way that I mean, there's very rarely a day when I have a problem in something, I can't do something in the orchestra. It's her voice I hear most of the time, you know, and it was such a beautiful thing. We didn't, however, spend a lot of time on finger exercises and stuff like that, because she thought that this was the most important thing. And actually, you know, funnily enough, making your fingers better is just a case of practice, yeah. You know, but learning about colour and finding colour, that's something that you can't teach, but you have to learn. And she was brilliant at it, you know. And I think that stood me in good stead, actually.
That's wonderful, because I'm in total agreement in that, you know, just about everybody can move their fingers if they put their mind to it. But to think about the colour and what you're trying to say. I mean, I remember Peter Lloyd, when he talked about when he did auditions, he said he was looking for someone who could play a beautiful line. That was what he was worried about. All he wanted was someone who could speak to him and move him in a musical way. And he wasn't worried about fingers.
Exactly. I think it's the most important thing, really, because as you say, I mean, you know, I mean, there are some players around today who can play stuff that I could only dream about playing in some ways. But actually, I mean, I was asked to record a brand new concerto a couple of years ago by Douglas Nyans, an American-Australian composer. And he's a flute player himself, and he sent me the music. And I just thought, I'm actually not sure I can play this. It's too hard. It's really difficult. And when you see the score, it's relentless, and it's all these slurs over three octaves at really fast speeds. And I thought, Gareth, pull yourself together. You're principal flute in the LSO. You're supposed to be able to do stuff like this. And of course, I don't get out of the orchestra that much. I love playing in the orchestra. I mean, the schedule's so punishing. I don't actually have time to do much solo work anyway. But I did learn it, and I realised that actually it was okay. It just took a lot of time and effort. And I think that's where, you know, sometimes you just have to do it. But you know, the fingers are just muscles. It, you know, it's not complicated. They just go up and down, and you have to put them up and down in the right order, really. The difficult stuff's all up here, and whether you can have something to say. So, I mean, I've always been interested in the line of the music and the phrasing of the music. And of course, in the orchestra, that happens with 100 people doing it, thinking as one, which is why it's so exciting.
Yeah, very well said. I'm in total agreement. Let me take you back a little bit to auditions. What's happening today with auditions for the conservatoires?
Well, actually, I spent the last 2 days watching auditions. It's difficult at the moment. The orchestral artistry course at the Guildhall, I've been listening to auditions from people from all over the world, and it's the audition for that is kind of a bit like an orchestral audition, in that you have to play the first exposition of one of the Mozart concertos, a contrasting piece, and then a selection of excerpts. I think it's about 4 or 5 orchestral excerpts, and they have all been, you can record them yourself at home or wherever you are, and then you have to upload them to the website. Now, the idea is that when you play the excerpts, you have to do it all in one go. So you can't just, you know, edit your best selection of excerpts. It has to be done like an audition. Yeah. And, you know, what I have found really useful about that is, as I don't need to tell you, but anybody that's ever sat on an audition panel, you do get fatigued, because you hear the same instrument in the same room, the same pieces over and over and over again. And I've often, you know, people often say, is it good to go first, or is it better to be last, or don't go after lunch because they'll be sleepy? I don't know what they're eating for lunch, but, you know, and everybody's got their own theory. I think basically just play well is the best way, because when you hear lots of people, you know, after a while, they all start sounding the same. And it's that one person that can play the line and does do something that you think, oh, wow, that's really good. They stick out. So it's not about when you play, it's how you play. But what has been good is I was reading my reports that I'd written yesterday, and there were 15 of them I saw over the last 2 days. So I was able to spread it out over 2 days, whereas normally I'd be in that same room all day. And by the end of it, you feel like your brain's fried. And I looked at my comments, and I went back to the first one, because I thought I was quite harsh on the first one. And I went back and listened, and having then heard everybody again, I listened to them all twice. I mean, I was a bit more selective on the second one. I didn't sit through the whole thing, but it was quite interesting, because I was able to think, okay, well, actually, you know what? There were things that I was quite critical of, that they were actually much better than most of the other people. And that's something which in a normal audition situation I couldn't do. You know, you just have to go on, you hear them once, that's it. And then you often can't remember what they even look like, because you've seen so many people, you know. So that's been quite interesting. I mean, I'm trying to look for the positives, of course.
Yeah.
It's been interesting hearing people like
that. Yeah, I mean, I also remember doing 30 years of auditions, and, you know, you'd have day after day listening to flute players, and it becomes a little bit of a blur.
It is. I remember actually when I joined the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, and I was 22, 23, and Kathleen, who was the second flute player at the time, who is now the piccolo player in the BBC Symphony Orchestra, I was in the orchestra for about 6 months, and she left. I mean, it wasn't because I joined, I'm sure. But, you know, she was doing other things and wanted to do other things. And so I found myself at the age of 23 with very little experience at that point, having to audition for a second flute player. And it was weird seeing the list of names of people who'd been in years above me at college and people I really respected. And I was suddenly sitting on the other side of the fence from them. And it was a very uncomfortable situation, actually, for me. And I remember sitting there and, you know, everybody marks differently. Some people just write comments. Other people have complicated marking systems. And, you know, just to give myself a sort of a rough guide. And I was marking these people. And, you know, the first one was quite good. I thought it was quite good, but they were, you know, intonation was a bit. So I'll give them a 7. Then the next one will come in, play exactly the same pieces. I go, okay, well, they were quite good as well. Then I'll give them a 7.5. And then the next one will come in. I go, oh, well, they were better than this. Anyway, like by the morning break, I'd got 15 or so flute players, all with a mark between 7 and 8 with various decimal points. And they were all really good. And I turned to the principal oboe who'd been there for years. And I said, I don't know how to do this. I don't know what to do. He said, don't worry. It will be fine. It will be obvious. And then halfway through the afternoon, than everybody else, that all I didn't literally put the others in the bin, but all of a sudden all these tiny little fractions of stuff became immaterial because there was this one person who had it all and just a level above. And so it was an important moment for me because I thought, you know, you don't need to do something to be different, but you need to just elevate yourself. And normally that's in what you have to say. You don't have to try and say something unique. I mean, you know, it's very dangerous to think you've got to stamp your mark on a piece. It's the Mozart flute concerto. We've heard it a million times. So I'm going to do this crazy thing. Yeah. That's not how it goes. You need to serve the music and you need to play it well, but you need to, you know, I want to hear people play and hear that they know what Mozart's supposed to sound like. You know, I mean, I've heard too many auditions where the Mozart flute concerto sounds not dissimilar to the Daphnis and Chloe solo. And, you know, they're from different eras of music and they shouldn't sound the same and other times.
Yeah, I'm sorry, we got a little bit distorted at the end, but the gist was that you're saying that, you know, Mozart shouldn't sound like Ravel and there should be stylistic differences to play the music and not try and show off something.
Yeah, exactly.
All good advice. Now, you've sort of answered one of my questions, which is in an audition situation, I'd mentioned what three things would you be listening for? So we're listening for the line, the phrase, projecting the music.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, I go for them when you, if you were to audition, and you know, we do have 2 vacancies in the LSO flute section at the moment, which we're not advertising or auditioning for obvious reasons, but we will do at some point in the near future. And when you audition for the LSO, and it's similar to lots of orchestras, you do a first round, which is behind a screen. So we don't know who you are, where you've come from. It's a great leveler. And actually, you know, when you do have a CV, as everybody does when they come out of college, it's got nothing on it. You know, I don't really want to know about when you won your concerto competition in West Wickham when you were 15. It's kind of irrelevant if you want to play in the LSO. I want, if you've got a CV and it's not got anything on it because you're 20, that's totally normal. And you shouldn't shy away from it. Don't fill it with a load of nonsense. I want to know where you studied, who you studied with, and what you've done, and that's it. And if it's, I've only played in the college orchestra, that's okay. I mean, we've employed people who've only done that, you know. But you will turn up, you'll have your first audition, you'll play a bit of Mozart and maybe 2 excerpts, and that's all you will get. And it won't even be the first exposition of the Mozart, it'll be the first 2 minutes. So your audition will be 5 minutes long, and that's it. And if we like you and we hear something, and we do give people the benefit of the doubt because we are looking for somebody. It's not an exam. You know, if you're doing an exam at your college and people are marking going, yes, well, he obviously didn't listen to that class because he's still doing that and he hasn't worked on that. We're not interested. Is this person somebody I can work with? Are they going to fit in the LSO? Am I going to be able to work with them for 25 years? You know, that's what we're looking for. So we're actually on your side, which I think people often forget. I really don't want to sit through a day of awful playing. I really want to hear great playing. And then in the second round, there'll be no screen. So you get to see us, we get to see you. And then we'll ask you lots of things and we will sort of prod you and poke you and see what you can do. If I've heard your Mozart and thought, that's good, but I'm not sure about that articulation, I will ask you the Mendelssohn Scherzo from Midsummer Night's Dream. If I'm not sure I've heard a good musical line, I will ask you Daphnis. If I want to be really nasty because I just don't like you, I will ask you the Classical Symphony. I've never actually asked that in a first round, in any principal flute audition, because personally I consider it to be a pointless exercise. I do, however, ask second flutes to play in auditions, and I sit down and play the first flute part with them in a second round, which seems fair. But I'm listening in that first round. I'm actually listening to really basic things, and they're so basic that people often forget them. And they are, the first one is intonation. You know, the number of people that won't tune to the piano properly and play out of tune, take 30 seconds to tune it. I'd rather wait for you to tune and hear the piece in tune than listen to it out of tune because you rust your tuning. It's important. We all tune. The intonation is not an added extra. And the number of people, when they play the excerpts on their own, they forget about it. And, you know, when it gets loud, they get really sharp. And when it gets quiet, they get really flat. All problems on the flute, but we're all aware of them. And the thing that my biggest thing that I would want to let people know auditioning is that the panel, you know, I know lots of people, I don't sort of frequent flute conventions and things like that very much. I'm not really a flute geek. I don't particularly like the flute. I play the flute and I like it because I can do what I want on it. But I love playing in the orchestra. When you play at a flute convention and you play your variations on La Traviata or whatever, and it's got millions of arpeggios and scales and everything, it's all terribly impressive. Don't play that in an orchestral audition because nobody's interested and it's irrelevant. We expect you to have technical command of your instrument. That's kind of a given. But what you need to remember is that when you're playing at a flute convention, you're playing to flute players and probably some long-suffering husbands and wives who are dragged along. But they're all flute players and they'll go, wow, what a great flute player. On a panel, you're playing to usually the woodwind section for flute audition, maybe a few string players. And they're not interested in the flute. They're interested in the music. And when you play something like one of the solos from a Brahms symphony, for example, the clarinet player is hearing the whole thing, not just the flute section. He knows what it sounds like. And she will hear what she has to play at that moment in time. And so it's so much about the music. And that's so important. And if it's out of tune, even though you've got no accompaniment, everybody in that audition can hear that you're out of tune. They don't need the piano to know that you're out of tune. If you cannot play in tune, you cannot play in the orchestra. And that, you know, we all know what the problems are. It's that simple. And it's not hard to play in tune. People just don't take enough care sometimes. You know, it's about changing the angle of where you blow. It's perfectly easy to do. But I hear too many solo, too much solo playing where it's like, well, I'm going to play loudly in the bottom register and it goes flat. And then in the top register, when they go diminuendo and it goes quiet, you can't do that if you're playing unison with the violins. You just can't do it. So intonation, that's the number one thing for me. The second thing is pulse and rhythm. Now, you know, if you play in a youth orchestra, you get a conductor giving a nice clear beat. If you've ever watched any LSO videos with Valery Gergiev, for example, you try and follow that beat. And from a conductor, you get the speed, but you don't always get the pulse. You have to have your own pulse. And that pulse links up with everybody else in the orchestra and you have this internal pulse. Now, we all do that thing sometimes where if you want to make something sound more exciting, you get louder. And how many times have you had to say, Claire, I'm sure, you know, crescendo doesn't mean get faster. And diminuendo does not mean get slower. And if every time you get faster all the time, you've got to drag 90 people with you. So you need to have a really good internal pulse. The number one excerpt for hearing that is Leonora 3, you know, the bit where it goes, goes to the triplets. 95% of the time people get that wrong. And it's just because they aren't listening to their own internal pulse. So an internal pulse is, and the rhythm is so important. And the third thing for me is context. And as I just said about the thing, you know, if you're playing Daphnis and Chloe, I expect you to use vibrato and be French and exotic, but I expect you to play it in tempo because you can't just pull it around to do whatever you like. But any fool can do that. Playing it, spreading it all over the place to make it sound lovely is easy. Playing it robotically is easy, but playing it in time and making it sound like you're improvising, that is the skill. And that's what's so difficult. But if you play Ravel like that, and then you play an excerpt from Mozart and you use the same vibrato, and you play a Beethoven symphony and you're using your late 19th century vibrato, it's just not acceptable anymore. You cannot do that. You need to have context. You know, it used to be that if you play Baroque music, that was a specialism. It's no longer like that, you know? And even if you don't want to play the Baroque flute, which is fine, you know, you can't do everything, you cannot claim to not be aware of it anymore. So if you're still playing the Mozart flute concerto like it's 1978, then you need to listen to some new recordings and listen to people like Rachel Brown, you know? Don't try and sound like you're playing a classical flute, but you have to be aware of the stylistic implications of that. Otherwise, you know, the great thing about the LSO is the flexibility and the breadth of work that we do. And if you play all the time in one way, this is my vibrato, take it or leave it, that's just not going to wash anymore. And it certainly won't wash with the flutes, the oboes, the clarinets and the bassoons and the violinists on the panel.
I must say, that's one of my main gripes, the overuse or the regular use of vibrato, regardless of what anyone plays. So that's really good information, Gareth, fantastic. And that's great advice, whether you're auditioning for a music college or whether you're auditioning for the orchestra. People take that on board. Now, because of all the restrictions we're in at the moment, how are you teaching?
I actually am a guest, what's it called? Visiting professor at the Guildhall. I mean, I don't teach as much as I used to, really, because, until recently, the LSO does 70 concerts a year in the Barbican and usually another 70 concerts abroad. This year, we were supposed to be doing 99 concerts out of the country. Yeah. Now, I take my teaching very seriously, as I know lots of people do. And I have to say that the teachers at the Guildhall are very dedicated to what they do. And I was the same at the Royal College, and I was teaching there, and I would teach for 2 weeks. And it was mainly the advanced students who wanted to learn about the orchestra and stuff. And I was teaching there, and then I would have to go away for 3 weeks on tour. And the number of times it was the 3 weeks before an exam and stuff. And then I'd come back and I'd do another couple of lessons. And, you know, that works for some people. I just felt like I was letting them down and I wasn't doing it properly. And I couldn't be there to teach properly. And so I made a decision to not do it like that. So I do lots of classes. I still go into the Guildhall to do orchestral classes. I have one student at the moment and I only give her 9 lessons a year. And it's really about orchestral stuff. But she also gets to come and sit in the LSO, and she comes to loads of rehearsals, and I'm always around to ask questions and for advice and stuff like that. And that sort of works best for me. I was doing a class the other night with the University of North Texas flute department, and that was online, and that's not something I would have been able to do before. Nobody would have asked me to do it, you know? So actually it's opened up the world in that sense. And I found that teaching a lot of it, there are some things which are better. I mean, you know, I found it's that the attention that you have to give online is less tiring for me. I mean, I always try and give quite a lot when I'm teaching, and I'm finding it less tiring because I don't have to travel anywhere. But what most of it works fine. The one thing I'm still having issues with is the sound quality. And it's not even, I mean, they all sound kind of okay on Zoom. It depends, as we're discovering this morning, what the connection is like, of course. And that just seems to be a lottery. I don't know how that works. But the thing I found, I mean, I had a new student this year, and I heard her play online, and it sounded, it was all very good. And I wrote comments, yeah, this is great, this is great. And it sounded really good. And when I met them in person and heard them for the first time, the sound still, it was a good quality sound, but it sounded like it was a big sound. And in real life, everything was much, much smaller on a smaller scale. And that was a bit of a shock. And so I had to actually retain that sound in my head, because I see her sometimes, sometimes it's online. And that's the thing. I think probably, I mean, you'll know about this, but I think probably if you know somebody's playing before lockdown, then online makes more sense. But I found hearing people for the first time, and I've done quite a lot of stuff like that, that I'm finding that's more difficult. I found myself more than once yesterday writing reports saying, I think the sound is a bit thin, but I wouldn't like to, you know, make judgment because I can't hear. And there's so much physicality about the way sound hits you anyway. You know, that's the one thing that's difficult, I find.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult to actually be almost secure in your decisions or in your thoughts about the people you're listening to. And it all depends on,
yes, exactly,
on the type of microphones they're using as well. So it's, you know, some people have got a great setup, and other people have just got the basic computer, which they're using the computer microphone. So it's difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We were, I was talking about this just before I spoke to you this morning with some students at the Guildhall. And I think it's funny because, you know, people will often say, oh, they've got really expensive microphones, they've got this, they've got that. It's actually often, there are some things that people can do, and I think they're going to need to, because, you know, I know everybody's getting excited about vaccines and things like that, but it's, you know, the world isn't going to go back to normal. I don't think it should go back to normal anyway. But I think that it's going to take a months before things get back to normal. And I think that the online stuff that we're doing, I don't think that's going to go away. I think it's kind of kickstarted it more. It's been coming, but, you know, being able to do stuff online is something that's coming. And I think for quite some time, you know, if we advertise a job in a year's time, I think such a simple decision as it perhaps was, I mean, it's probably going to be more expensive, I would imagine, anyway. And also the implications of that travel are more important than, well, maybe people think about them more than they did before, for you know, the reasons of the virus, but also climate change and things like that. You know, it's, you need to consider how they record things to make it easy. You know, we weren't caught unawares with the Where's Simon, and we recorded, I think, at home. Am I still there?
Yes, you're still here.
I think that having to record yourself at home is not going to go away for quite some time. And I think it's probably a skill which lots of people have had to embrace, assignment at college. But I think there are a few things you can do. Because some people just think, oh, I'll just do that, that will be fine, that's all I've got. You know, we don't all have concert halls at home, obviously. I mean, my music, you know, in it, the rest of it's got piles of shoes, and there's washing on the radiator, and there's an exercise bike, and all my wife's art stuff over there. You know, it's a total mess. We got asked to do videos for the LSO various times. Could you film yourself in front of a white wall? And I was looking around my house going, no, I don't have a wall that doesn't have either pictures on it or stuff on it or a dirty mark on it or something. And so, you know, we're not geared up for it. But what we did do was, I wrote a project called Where's Simon, which is an education project that's online with Simon Rattle. And the orchestra, this was during the first full lockdown, the orchestra recorded themselves individually. I prepared a track, a click track and a guide track, and they recorded their individual parts of the Marriage of Figaro overture. And about 70% of the people didn't have a microphone and just recorded it on their phones. Yeah. And our recording engineers put it through reverb and stuff like that. And if you hear it now, it's obviously not the LSO in a recording session, but the sound is pretty good. And you don't need to spend very much. And you know what? People will spend all sorts of money on extra gizmos for their flute, which promise to definitely improve everything a million times for your £15,000 flute for a mere £50. If you attach this or you stick this up the end or you use whatever, surely spending £50 on a microphone that sounds better than your mobile phone is equally, if not much more, of an investment. If you've got a Mac, you can use GarageBand. It's got reverb on it. So if you're playing in room like this, this room has got no particular acoustic. Everything sounds really loud in it. But I've done several professional recording sessions for film soundtracks in the last 2 months. And I've recorded in here. And once you put reverb on it, as long as the traffic stops, it sounds very good. One thing I would say, if you are doing a recording for an audition, for anything, please watch it. Don't just record it and press send. The number of people I've had where literally I can see their underwear on the radiator, which you could have, if you just moved that, you know, maybe you don't notice it because it's always there. And the number of people where I can see their chin because the camera's slipped or something like that, or they've played and they haven't checked the sound level. And so the whole thing sounds like they're doing a concerto for chainsaw and they just sent it off. And I think, well, you know, it took you 20 minutes to record it, spend another 20 minutes, watch it through once, get your mum to watch it, do anybody to watch it to go, actually, you can hear the dog barking in that primitive or something like that. You know, I'm amazed at how many people don't check it. It's a really simple thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I also have the same thing with these podcasts, Gareth, that I have to listen back very, very carefully to make sure that everything comes out properly. And I think I'm going to have to do quite a lot of editing here because we keep losing you and have to keep reattaching you. So
that sounds painful.
So I'm hoping it'll all come together. How has the LSO adapted then to this pandemic, you know, with your live performances? Are you all online? Have you met up? What have you done?
Yeah, well, I mean, the LSO is a real survivor of an orchestra. You know, it's got through two world wars and financial crises and all sorts of things. And the LSO, more than lots of other big orchestras in Europe, is very light on its feet. And we have I was the chairman of the orchestra because we're a self-governing orchestra run and owned by the players. And, you know, we have a wonderful managing director, Catherine McDowell, who comes up with ideas. And, you know, if you have an idea for something, say, I think maybe we should do this. And she'll go, okay, yeah, right, let's do it. And suddenly it's in the schedule and you think, right, oh, we're really doing this. Like, for instance, the Where's Simon project I mentioned, I emailed her and said, I've got an idea for this project. What do you think? And she called me back and said, well, we've been looking for something interesting. This is a great idea. Okay. And there we go. So, and all of a sudden we're doing it. And then Simon's calling me going, yeah, let's do this. It's, I mean, you know, that's madness. It just happens so fast. Of course, we, like everybody else, we have to abide by the restrictions. And of course, I've seen, you know, countless ideas of people with screens and sort of masks that you put on your flute and stuff like that. We are really fortunate because, of course, we were told by the government to stop playing and doing concerts, and then everything was locked down. But we're all self-employed, so many of us have had no financial help at all. So, you know, a lot of people don't realise that, I don't know what the percentage is, but a huge percentage of musicians are self-employed. So if we don't work, we don't get paid. All our concerts stopped, all our touring stopped. There's no money coming in, you know. And that's tough. That's really tough. And I and lots of my colleagues didn't get any money from the self-employment scheme because of the government's wisdom. That's a whole other podcast. It's been a struggle in that sense. But we are really fortunate. 15 years ago, there was an old church on Old Street that was literally falling down. It had no roof, an old Hawksmoor church. And the LSO raised millions of pounds. And we lease it from Islington Council, and it's our education centre. It's called LSO St Luke's. Some of you will have been there. If you haven't seen it, look it up, because it, from the outside, it looks like an old church. And then you go inside and it's just this massive space with these metal pillars that hold the roof up. Old Street goes past outside next door. One of the busiest roads in London. Cannot hear it. It's got windows which are, I think, 3 inches thick or something, double glazing, triple glazing, I don't know. Anyway, we can play in there, and we have got a one-way system. It's COVID secure. And we have now, if you go on to the LSO YouTube channel, there are lots of videos of us playing. You can see we're all playing socially distanced, which has changed slightly. So we have to wear masks when we're not at our chairs. String players have to wear masks all the time. Wind players are allowed to take them off only when we're sitting in our chair playing. The wind players have to sit 3 meters apart. Now, it's a huge distance, and it's taken a long time to get used to it. We have to remain socially distanced at all times. And we were lucky when we came out of the first lockdown, we were able to have an audience, but the audience was 12 people. And they sat up in the balcony. So when you watch, you'll see the strings take up almost the whole of downstairs. It's a huge amount of people. The wind are right at the back of the place, because the strings have screens, Perspex screens as well, because they're only 2 meters apart. And the brass are up in the balcony. So you can imagine the distance is really, it's like learning again. It's like somebody's changed the rules that I've been playing by for the last 25 years. We've always had a big online presence, and so we've been fortunate. Lots of European broadcasters have been buying our broadcasts, and we're putting out free ones on YouTube. So there's loads and loads of content that you can watch, and we've been doing that. So normally we're doing one concert a week. Well, not every week. My next concert is actually not till December the 15th. Something like that. So it's quite, you know, there are big gaps. So obviously financially, again, it's not great. But the thing for me, I mean, when lockdown started, I was working 7 days a week, essentially. I mean, we regularly, I think the longest stretch I've done is 40 days without a day off. Now, 40 days without a day off is a long time. Traveling around playing pieces at the highest level for 40 days is really punishing. We often get young players that come in for the first time. They've learnt their pieces for the first trial. They do really well. And then the second one, they haven't had as much time to prepare. And, you know, the skill, anybody can do one good concert if you've prepared enough. But doing it day after day after day, the repertoire we get through is huge. Well, now all of a sudden, when it got to the beginning of lockdown, I just stopped. I didn't play my flute for 2 months. I've never done that before. It's lovely. There, it turns out there's these 2 days at the end of every week called a weekend. I never knew about them. It's really nice. I've enjoyed them. And, you know, my family still speak to me. And it's been really nice. I haven't missed people's birthdays because I'm not away. I didn't really miss playing at all. As I said to you, I'm not a big flute geek. I didn't think, oh, I've got to get my flute out. I've got to play. I don't go on holiday to do my Tafl and Gobert. I'm like, well, that's not a holiday then, is it? I stop playing when it's, you know, because how boring would life be if you only played the flute? Blimey. So I didn't play. I didn't really listen to much music. And I had a moment where I think my wife was doing some Zoom call with some of her friends. What my eldest son had just, you know, my eldest son lives in London. My youngest son had just graduated from Norwich with English, and he had to, much against his wishes, come live back home again. And my daughter was doing online stuff at school, and I found myself with like a couple of hours and I couldn't go anywhere. And it was the last day where you could watch a broadcast of Claudio Abbado's final concert before he passed away, with the Lucerne Festival Orchestra doing Mahler 9. It's one of my favourite symphonies. And I'd heard Abbado conduct the Berlin in the Proms in about 1988, 89. And I can still remember that concert. It was amazing. And I thought, I'm going to watch that because everybody says it's really good. So I thought, I'm going to sit down on my own and watch this concert. Now, it may sound weird in that I'm surrounded by music all the time and I'm playing music all the time. I very rarely get to watch it. I actually can't tell you what the last concert I went to see was that wasn't a school concert, because I'm never free. So I sat down, I made a cup of tea, sat down and watched this, and it was completely overwhelming. And it was amazing. I just thought, oh my God, this, I mean, I've played that, but I don't know how many times I've played it, but to hear it, and it was a very emotive occasion anyway, because it was, you know, you knew that Claudio was, it was his last thing. And boy, he could do that piece, but it was totally overwhelming. And I think I wouldn't have found it as overwhelming if I'd watched it in the midst of my schedule. And it made me think, you know, it's very easy, because even now there's no silence around us. We're not, you know, if you don't make music yourself, you just consume it. It's still very available. I think that we often, and certainly I am, to be able to do it. And also how sometimes pieces like the Big Mahler symphonies just get abused because you hear them so much that they lose their impact. And having not had it and not being able to play it and then see it, I was in bits at the end of it. And I picked up my flute again and was like, oh yeah, no, this is nice. And it was really nice just to make music for myself a bit. But then in the summer, we were lucky enough to be one of the orchestras that played in the Proms. And now it's really weird. I mean, I love playing at the Proms. I hate playing in the Albert Hall. It's not my favourite hall. It's really difficult. But 6,000 people watching you in the Proms, it's great. It's like nothing else. It's an amazing experience. And of course, there was no audience. So it's just us. And that hall, if you've ever rehearsed in the Albert Hall without an audience, it's like a big warehouse. You hear everything 15 times. And we play, it was a typical Simon Rattle programme, some Kurtag, some Vaughan Williams, Mitsuko Shida played the first movement, the Moonlight Sonata. It's probably still an iPlayer, I guess. And it was filmed for the TV. And we played Vaughan Williams Symphony. And, you know, I love playing Vaughan Williams. Don't play it very often. And we played it and it was just so moving, even knowing that people were watching at home, but there was nobody in the hall. And it was kind of like this giant metaphor for this separation that we're all feeling, but so important. And I hope that when we come back, that people are desperate. They want to come and see culture. Because, you know, I do sometimes think that we take for granted in this country our orchestras. We're so fortunate to have so many good orchestras. And it's kind of like use it or lose it. I mean, I'm always amazed. I remember I did a recital for the British Flute Society, the only thing I've really ever done, a few years ago, and it was full of flute players, including my first ever flute teacher in the front row. It was terrifying. And I played in the Duke's Hall, the Academy, and some students of Trevor's actually came up to me at the end, and they were very nice, very nice. And they were all saying, oh, you know, you should do this. You should record. I played Reinecker, I think, and some Leppomedy. And, oh, have you recorded it? I said, no. Well, you should record it. I said, well, okay, I don't really particularly have the urge to. I don't really think the world needs another solo flute recording. But somebody else came up to me and said, oh, have you done any recordings? And I said, well, yeah. I mean, hundreds of recordings. I've recorded Leppomedy twice, Daphnis, Petrushka, Feibach, you know, all the big flute stuff, all the Beethovens, all the Brahms. And I said, well, yeah, I've done lots. And I said, well, you know, they've done that for me. No, but flute recordings. And there was this kind of, I don't think that people particularly know who I am. The number of people that will only listen to solo, if you don't do that, it's like you don't really exist. And I've, I've always found it really weird because, as in my opinion, people will take a few pieces, but I think the stuff in the orchestra is so wonderful and so great to play. You know that old thing, if you ever play the Mozart flute concerto, the program note always says Mozart didn't like the flute. And I'm thinking, well, A, I don't think that's true. And you only need to play any of Mozart's music in the orchestra with the flute in to know that that simply isn't the case.
Yeah.
So it's kind of frustrating sometimes.
Very frustrating, and you can count the solo, the most successful solo flute players on one hand, really. The work really is in the orchestral and chamber music field, So much fantastic writing for flute. So you're very lucky because you get.
And I don't really have time to do much else. I don't really have time to do much else. It's so busy.
I know you're terribly busy, but when you do get a chance to relax in normal times, do you have a hobby?
Well, yeah. I mean, I read a lot. I like reading, not really books about music, but just all sorts of things. My wife is paints a lot. As an orchestral musician, when you travel to different countries, you tend to go to big cities and capital cities. And if we have a free afternoon, I love being able to go to a gallery. I just love doing that and seeing pictures and just having the time to. So I really enjoy that. I mean, my main hobby, I mean, it's funny because music is kind of I guess it would have been my hobby anyway. So it takes up such a lot of time that I don't do lots of other things. The one thing I do a lot of, the most of, is running. Well, I started, I was quite ill about 15 years ago, and I had to take some time off work, and I thought about not really coming back, and I got through it, and I thought, I just have to, you know, when you have a big health moment, you think, right, I'm going to have to look after myself. I'm not getting any younger. And so I tried to get fit. And, you know, whenever you go anywhere around the world with the orchestra, there's, you know, various types of gyms in hotels. And I find them soulless places, and they're always full of the orchestra. And, you know, there's not much point in standing around waiting for a running machine. So there's quite a few people that run in the LSO. And I just started doing it. I hated it at first, but then got into it. And actually, it's been a really nice thing on tour to suddenly go and explore somewhere. Actually, you know, you can get a lot further running. And obviously it keeps me fit and healthy, and it helps me mentally. You know, when things are getting me down, I just go out for a run. I mean, unfortunately, I live in Surrey, and in 5 minutes I can be up on the North Downs and feel like I'm in the middle of nowhere. And I find that really, really helpful. And also, I often come up with some of my best ideas of things to do. If I'm mulling over an idea about something, I'll do that. I can think about that. And quite often, if I've got to play a new piece, I can remember we did Cycle of Prokofiev Symphonies with Gergiev years ago. And I, like lots of people, I knew five, I knew seven, and I knew the classical, but I didn't know any of the other ones. So I downloaded them all, and I would run along listening to them. And you suddenly realize which movements of Prokofiev are really good running tempos. It's really, some of them are really great, but I'll often use that time for learning repertoire as well. Just to get a feel for it and stuff like that. So that, you know, I it's a kind of catch-all thing that I do.
Yeah. And it's really good. Really good. Again, advice for people listening, because it's so good for mental health to go and do something different, get out and do something, and looking after your health and your physical and your mental health.
I think if you know, particularly, I've never really considered. I remember Philippa Davis taught me when I was at the Guildhall for a couple of years, and you know, she said something to me which I reminded her of, and I was playing, and I can't remember what provoked her to say it particularly, but she said, "You have to decide in your life, do you want to be people to say he's a really great flute player?" Or do you want them to say he's a really great musician? And I've always erred on the musician. So I've got terrible embouchure. I mean, Ed Beckett spent months trying to straighten it. I blow out the side of my mouth, and it doesn't look good, but it works. I spent a long time trying to be good at the flute, but you try and be good at the flute so you can forget about the flute and then make music. And that's, I think, involves being a good musician means being good at music, obviously, being good at your instruments so that you can just forget about the technical stuff to some extent. It never leaves you completely, of course, and I have all my own problems which I'm not going to list here, but also just finding out about other things, you know. I mean, I've fought ferociously hard to keep some kind of normality in my life. You know, I have been married for 25 years. My wife and I went to school together. So she's not a musician. She was a midwife for years. And she still thinks I'm really good. And nobody's told her otherwise. So it's actually, you know, and I have my three children. And actually now it's great because I'm able to spend more time doing stuff. And I've tried to do that because, you know, one day I've seen many, many great players come through the LSO and leave and don't know what to do with themselves. And I don't want to be one of those people. And so looking after everything else is much more important to me. I mean, if I had to give up one thing out of everything else in the LSO, it would be the orchestra. I mean, I've done it for 20 years. I love it. And it's been a huge privilege for me. But my family is more important than that. Yeah. And life in general, you know.
Yeah. Well, Gareth, I think on that note, that's probably a very good place for us to stop today. But I really would love to talk to you again because we haven't even got on to your writing and the show must go on. And I'd love to hear more about your times in the orchestra and things that have happened when, you know, good things and bad things and funny things. So.
No problem. Well, I'm here. So.
We must chat again, but thank you for being so refreshingly honest. And it's lovely to hear you chat about things. I think people should go and look at your website, which I think is GarethDavisOnline.com.
That's right. I should probably update it then.
You should probably update it. But for the moment, thank you ever so much for chatting, and let's catch up again really soon.
Pleasure.
Talking Flutes and Talking Flutes Extra are podcast productions by the Trevor James Flute Company. For more information, visit trevorjamesflutes.com.